Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Two men from different generations, both alive with the fierce urgency of the fight for personal freedom and democracy, both living in exile, with no idea whether they can ever return home. I'm David Taylor, and this week on the Slow News podcast, we've been talking to Dr. Tung Biao and Simon Cheng, two men who have paid a price for daring to challenge China's ruling Communist Party. As China uses the COVID-19 pandemic to crack down even further on dissent, we wanted to find out about President Xi's apparatus of suppression, the formidable machinery of state control. And we wanted to know, what is it like to be one of the disappeared?
Slow News is a podcast made by us, here at Tortoise. We're a news publisher, in an app, online, in our daily SenseMaker email, and, as you already know, in podcasts. What's different about us is that we investigate what's driving the news, and we'd love for you to join us. By becoming a member of our newsroom, you'll get access to our journalism, and you can join our open news meetings and help decide what matters in the world, and how we should report it. To get access to all of Tortoise, all you have to do is download our app and take the free trial. Go to tortoisemedia.com/podtrial and help make the news.
So I'm joined today by Tung Biao. Dr. Biao, how are you? And can you tell everyone where you're calling from today?
I live in Princeton, New Jersey, from the United States.
Where did you grow up?
I was born in Poor Village in Jilin Province, northeast China. I went to Peking University, actually the number one university in China, and I got my PhD in 2002. And then I became lecturer at a university based in Beijing.
And what was your specialism?
I taught jurisprudence, law and society, and law and literature, and constitutional law. So basically, legal theories.
Right. And was it a reasonably open environment in which to study and teach?
It's kind of interesting. Before I went to the university, I was brainwashed. And then I got opportunity to read books, and I met some independent thinking professors. And then I realized I had been cheated by the Communist Party's propaganda. And then I decided to become a scholar and human rights activist. Almost every scholar, every teacher had to practice self-censorship. But I'm kind of exception. I didn't practice self-censorship. I discussed all the sensitive issues with my students, and I became a human rights lawyer, and I was dealing with many politically sensitive cases.
Did that make you feel like you were a target for the Chinese government?
Yeah. So I was very critical of the Chinese government and the Communist Party and the political system. And then I was involved in many political cases, and I organized a couple of human rights organizations in Beijing. So I, of course, became the target of the government. And I, because of my work, I was banned from teaching and eventually fired by the university.
Wow. How did you respond to that?
I have to follow my own principle, my own conscience. And I think it's very important to promote human rights and rule of law in China. And there was kind of space, even though it's risky. And the human rights activists and political dissidents face harassment and persecution from time to time. And many of my friends were detained and tortured. But I feel it's my duty to do the human rights work.
Can you tell me about the first time you were arrested?
Like a few months before Beijing Olympics in 2008, I was trying to defend a human rights activist. And then I also wrote a lot of articles criticizing Beijing's human rights situation, especially before Olympics. And then I was kidnapped suddenly by the secret police just near my home in Beijing. And then they detained me for 2 days and 2 nights. And they interrogated me.
Just take me back a little step there. So what time of day was it, and what was the circumstance in which you were kidnapped?
I went back from bookstore, and I immediately after I parked my car, like near my apartment, and then 4 or 5 people called my name, and then they grasped me and pushed me into a car, and then I was screaming and I screaming, and I called for help and loudly, but they very quickly put me into their car and covered my mouth and covered my head with a hood, and then I was sent to kind of hotel. I didn't know where it was. So it's not arrest. It's not a formal detention. It's kidnap. It's a disappearance.
And was that, did you think, a calculated move to try and frighten you into silence?
Yeah. And I knew it's not an ordinary crime, because they printed my articles, my interviews, and all their interrogations were related to my articles and my cases, the human rights cases I was dealing with. So apparently they want to use that kind of abduction to punish me and to silence me.
Yeah, were you physically manhandled? Were you hurt during the interrogation?
During the abduction, they hurt me, but not seriously. And they intimidated me, and they told me they can charge me with incitement of state subversion, and they can sentence me for 5 years.
And if I'm understanding this correctly, you were detained for 2 days. It got much worse for you about 3 years later than that, in 2011. Can you just tell me what the mood was like in China at that time, and the circumstances leading up to your arrest?
Yeah. So I was frequently put under house arrest, and I was disbarred, and my passport was confiscated, but I didn't give up. I continued my human rights work, and I continue to write a lot of articles critical of the party. So in 2011, they kidnapped me again, The background is the Jasmine Revolution in Egypt and Tunisia, and somebody was calling for a similar protest in mainland China. And they listed some protest support of many major cities, and they called for people going to protest on February 28th, 2011. And one day before that day, I was kidnapped by Chinese secret police. And this time they detained me for 70 days.
70 days?
70, yeah. And they tortured me. So they slapped my face 50, 60 times. And I was deprived of sleep for a few days. And I was forced to sit down on the floor facing the wall and taking that position. If I moved a little bit, they would beat me. And I was forced to wear handcuffs, a pair of handcuffs 24/7. So that 70 days was kind of extreme form of solitary confinement.
How did you hold yourself together in that time?
It's very difficult because I was not allowed to read, to write, to call my family, to call my lawyer, to do anything. So I was deprived of any human information. So I had to go over the books I read. So the songs, the
oh, in your memory. Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yes. And to keep my, to actually, I tried my best to prevent me from being insane. And I even wrote a couple of novels in my memory. So it's difficult.
That's an extraordinary thing. Did you actually know where you were, and did you have any sense what might happen to you?
That's the hardest part. You know, 70 days for a political prisoner is not a long time. But if you didn't know how long they were going to detain you, and if you were intimidated every day, and if you were tortured, so that 70 days can be a nightmare. So I felt it's very, very long. And they never told you how long you would be released. And this time they also told me they might sentence me to 10 years. And for one time, they were transferring me from one detention place to another. And I was so scared. I was thinking they might be killing me. Because, you know, the background is Jasmine Revolution, and the government thought that we human rights lawyers and activists planned a protest overthrowing the government. And, you know, and if that's true, and the Chinese government would not be hesitating to kill the protesters, the dissidents. So I was so scared.
Dr. Tung was released, but it was into an increasingly hostile environment.
They forced me to write some confessions, and I will not write any articles criticizing the Chinese Communist Party.
He continued his activism, which caused him to move to Hong Kong to escape the Chinese police. But 5 years ago, even that proved too risky. And he fled to America.
Yeah, it's for me, it's very dangerous if I go to Hong Kong. Yeah, I never stopped my criticism against the Chinese government. And I've done a lot of human rights work based in the United States. So Hong Kong is not safe anymore for people like me.
The past few years have seen tensions rise in Hong Kong. There's a new generation of activists seized with the same passion and courage.
Well, I'm just a very usual, ordinary people who support democracy.
And still facing the same state oppression.
I've been stopped by the border force, by the immigration officers, and I keep asking what's the reason you stopped me. And then they said, oh, it's just based on these linear instruction by our senior leaders. They don't know what's going on. And I've been stopped for a while, and they're leaving me back to Shenzhen and hand me over to a bunch of plainclothes officers. They show no badges at that time and becomes very, very rude to me.
This kind of reporting's hard. We're dealing with fragments of facts and trying to build a picture. So it's important to find multiple accounts to corroborate and reinforce. This is Simon Cheng, a Hong Kong citizen who worked at the British consulate. But after he took part in last year's democracy protests, he found himself arrested while he was on a business trip in China.
And I kept asking why, the reason, and then they said, shut up. It's not the time you speak. And then they put me on the police car and delivered me to one of the police stations and start the horrible interrogation. So I've been put into the steel cell, very, very small cell, and they put me on a tiger chair. I would say like tiger chair is like a very cold steel chair, and they have a bar in front of your stomach, and that would be buckled up. You have been handcuffed and attached on the bar, so you cannot move at all. They gave no reason still, and until they asked a question, saying, what do you think about Hong Kong? Wow, I'm just, you know, so shocked, because I know they start to ask political question, and they said, whether you join the protest, what crime do you commit, please confess, and what's the roles behind the protest, and who and who you know who joined the protest. I'm just out of my imagination, you know. I never ever been detained, been interrogated. That's the first experience.
Mm. How did it feel?
Very intimidating. I'm very worried about my future, because they gave no reason. They showed no badges, and they wear no uniform. So it made me feel all the time so informal.
Yeah. Did they use physical force against you?
Afterwards, yes. The first few days still okay, and then they would just try to threaten you, and they would deliver me from police station A to B to C, trying to extend the detention period. And then they keep asking me to give them the passcode of the iPhone, and I reject, because that's
really,
yeah, that is work from contains some sensitive information about the consulate and internal information. So I always reiterate that I'm the star of the consulate and I was on the business trip. So it's based on the VR.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at UH1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
At a convention, I cannot give you what you want because that is about my work. And
were you able to have any contact with the outside world at this point?
Totally blocked out.
Man, it must have been really terrifying.
Yes, not only me and also my family members and my girlfriends, they are very worried about me, just disappear. The people got missing. And they keep asking me for passport and even said, why would you loyal to the UK government? You are Chinese. Why do you have to keep the secret for the UK government? Just give us the passport, etc. And I said, well, my phone now has been confiscated and that's on your hand. You can just simply access it, use any other way. You don't need my passport, I would say. It's because I couldn't break my ethic code as the staff of the consulate. I couldn't do it.
How many days did you ultimately get held for?
I have been held for 15 days. But for me, it seems like for life. Because you never ever could know, that is the fear, that they can detain you indefinitely. Because never ever I would say, after 15 days, you can be let out. Because they would say, we will increasingly charge you more and find more excuse to detain you. So that's the way I feel very scared.
Yes, and could you understand why they released you in the end?
Well, I guess it's because that's for three reasons. The first is that the UK government definitely, they tried to negotiate with the Chinese government. And from top down, that some senior officials knew about it and asked what's possibly they want to change the mindset, etc. And that is the diplomatic pressures, I would say. The second one is that I've shown quite cooperative attitude. I'm trying to be cooperative. And third one is that some protesters, actually the Hong Kong people, they quite support my case. They even had protests outside of the consulate. And even at that time, they even scheduled to surround the police station in Shenzhen.
And so tell me, that was August last year, I think, wasn't it? When did you feel that you needed to get out?
It's almost immediately. When I back to Hong Kong, I would feel, you know, the pressure just lit. But I would feel that's a huge difference at that time. Previously, when I just went for work, for business trip, I would feel, Shenzhen and Hong Kong is something similar, getting more and more similar. But now, after the ordeal I've been experienced, I still feel Hong Kong was free of law at that time. But I still feel unsafe because when I've been let out, when I've been before, just right before I've been let out, the staff, the secret police, and even the staff who were working for the State Council of Hong Kong and Macau office warned me if I speak out, if I speak anything other than soliciting prostitutions, they claim, they frame me up, and I've been detained. I've been abducted from Hong Kong to mainland China again.
I suppose absolutely the most positive thing we can say is that you're safe now, but do you have concerns still for your family, your girlfriend in Hong Kong?
Yeah, fortunately, my girlfriend came with me. So we're living together, but I cannot take care with my family members, especially my parents. My parents are actually getting old and now at the retirement age. So I'm a little bit worried about them. And I have no choice but need to cut ties, especially those secret police now come to Hong Kong. So I don't want to let them to be a hostage and try to manipulate me and also try to get the information or the status about me with them. So I need to cut ties. This is a puzzle. I don't know how to solve at this moment.
As we've just heard, Simon Cheng has only just been granted asylum in the UK. He's safe in London. But in Hong Kong, the story of the state versus the activists is still unfolding. And there's a new front in China's battle to control its people. My colleague Giles Wattel has been looking beyond the health emergency of COVID-19 to see what has happened during the pandemic to human rights in China. And Giles, I just wanted to start by asking you about Dr. Tung and his case. Is it an exception?
The short answer is no. The numbers of people in his position, human rights lawyers and activists who've really stuck their necks out, as it were, who have been disappeared has increased steadily in the course of Xi Jinping's time in power, that is since 2012, and particularly since the 709 crackdown of July 2015. But as I found reporting this story, the numbers are bigger than simply the numbers of known human rights activists and lawyers. The police themselves have boasted of penalizing, if not actually arresting, more than 5,000 people for disseminating what they call misinformation to do with COVID.
5,000? Hang on, 5,000 in the COVID moment?
Yes, in sort of this year, in the last few months alone. Which I think speaks very eloquently to the broader strategy of intimidation. In a country of 1.4 billion, ideally you don't have to arrest everybody to scare everybody. And so I think that's why the police are actually publicising these figures.
It seems like there was a window of opportunity which perhaps in their thousands, what we might think of as citizen journalists, have taken advantage of. And it seemed to boil down to this, that the Chinese authorities rather lost their grip and an opening was there and people began to use their technology to report on what they could see.
Absolutely. So this period seems to have straddled January and the early part of February when, as you say, citizens, and particularly medics or people seeing the way the virus impacted the hospitals in Wuhan, their instinct was to publicise it, to share that information, and actually not for the purposes of political subversion, but to save lives and get the word out that this was serious. And you're right, it does seem that the regime was wrong-footed. Most of those whom I've spoken to about this seem to think that the regime was wrong-footed. A good deal of this could have been because of the instinct of local party officials in the Wuhan area to suppress the release of information so that good information was not even getting to Beijing. But certainly there was that upsurge of citizen journalism and then the crackdown.
So they're back in charge with a vengeance, I think you memorably write.
Definitely. And those best-known cases that I focused on in the piece, we don't know where they are. And disappeared really does mean disappeared. And those who have been disappeared are being held under what they call residential detention in a designated location, which is a sort of ridiculous euphemism for being fully incommunicado, no contact with friends, family or lawyers, no electronic communication of any kind, in some cases an indication via intermediaries of where they're being held, so that one might know the city, for example. But other than that, they're properly disappeared. And that is, again, a part of a strategy of intimidation, which seems to be working.
Right. And when we spoke with Dr. Tung, he gave us a harrowing account of 70 days in detention and the fact that he was handcuffed and he was put in stress positions. He was tortured. Do we know anything about the what's happening to those people?
We don't. Human rights activists who cover this every day say they are all likely to be at least vulnerable to psychological and physical torture of the kind that Dr. Tang described. We don't know what's happening to them, and it should be said, I mean, the case of Li Zhehua is interesting. He is the one who had a profile and a job with State TV. In other words, he was an official state-approved journalist before the pandemic, went rogue, as it were, shortly after the pandemic took hold, was disappeared and has since reappeared and given what seems to be a coerced confession on TV. And from what he says, he wasn't mistreated at all. It's very hard to know on what terms he was released, but he went out of his way to say that the police took care of him, fed him, this kind of thing. It's extremely hard to know whether the others are being held in inhumane circumstances and only still being held because they're refusing to confess, or whether they're being treated more as Tang was.
Yes, yes. Which I suppose, so we know it. We know a little, we know fragments, we know meaningful things about circumstances of detention. What do we know about the apparatus of suppression? How industrial is it?
It's huge. The comparison that I was trying to reach for was, on a per capita basis, how many Chinese are involved in this apparatus compared with perhaps the most famous in the history of repression, that is the Stasi of East Germany. That number is very hard to come by, but the Public Security Bureau that has supervisory responsibilities for, well, that runs the police and sort of monitors the front line of this apparatus of repression is said to have 850,000 human informants in Beijing alone. And Professor Minxin Pei was describing to me not just one, but four, perhaps five layers of informants nationwide. The core informants who are on the payroll of the Public Security Bureau, another layer that he described as outer core informants who might monitor every class in every university, for example, or workplaces. Neighborhood committees, whose purpose is also to inform. Semi-civic organizations, he described them as. And then at least one more layer, depending on which part of China and the level of civic social tensions, which can include contractors, as Dr. Tang describes them, or part-time police who you might think of as vigilantes or just muscle. So the apparatus is huge, and you should, of course, remember that it is, well, rocket-fueled, as I put it in the piece, by technology. Nowhere uses cameras, facial recognition technology, voice recognition technology, and even gait recognition technology like China.
So yes, if they can't identify people's faces in a crowd, they can even recognize them by the way they walk.
In principle, yes. It's not clear whether this technology is sort of properly road tested yet. But we do know, of course, that they've got this huge laboratory for testing all kinds of information control technology and technology to control people out in Xinjiang in western China, where at least 1 million Uyghurs, the local Muslim ethnic minority, have been detained in huge purpose-built facilities. And in our thinking, some speakers said that that figure could be as high as 3 million.
I have to, just to finish, let's just try and, if we can, find some glimmer of optimism. Is there anything in your reporting that's given you hope or inspiration?
Yes. I mean, this brief flourishing of free speech and very determined sharing of the best information that people could find, medics and citizens in and around Wuhan in January and the early part of February, showed that habits of communication and sharing information may be being suppressed, but they're not being destroyed. Given the slightest chance and a very compelling reason to take risks by sharing information, thousands of people did. That's a great source of hope, I think.
Giles, thank you so much for joining us this week. And I really think it's of tremendous value that you've dug into all of this to give us an understanding of something which is shaping China right now. And I think it's probably right that we both thank all of those brave souls who've spoken with Tortoise this week.
Indeed. Thank you, Dave. And thanks to them too.
And I think it's probably right that we should give the last word this week in the podcast to Dr. Tong Biao. I found it incredibly humbling to speak with him this week.
Many Chinese activists don't give up. They will not give up. It's more risky. It's a very difficult time. But the Chinese activists are still thinking about the possibilities, the strategies and skills to promote human rights in China. and they cherish the value of freedom and human dignity, and they will not give up. We will have to experience all the atrocities in the coming years, but I really believe this kind of political system will not prevail.
Thanks for listening today. If you've enjoyed the podcast, then I think there's a really good chance that you'll also like a lot of the other stuff we do at Tortoise. There's a load of articles that you can read online. And because we're an open newsroom, there are tons of meetings that you can go to and you can help shape our journalism and the stories that we tell from wherever you are in the world. All you need to do is get our app. Just go to tortoisemedia.com/podtrial for our 30-day free trial. And of course, if you like this podcast, share it or give us a review or just tell somebody about it. Thanks for listening and see you next week.
Hong Kong is not just means a place or a city. It's about those bunch of people who love democracy and freedom. So wherever we walk or we are, we still think and we believe that one day we'll be back to our hometown with democracy and freedom.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, I'm investigative journalist Nicola Tallant, host of Crime World, a podcast all about criminals, drugs and the sins of the underworld in Ireland and across the globe. Join me and my guests for a peek into the world of gangland crime, dirty money and mysterious cold cases. With 5 brand new episodes per week, and sometimes even more, there's something for every type of crime podcast enthusiast. You can listen to Crime World now, wherever you get your podcasts.